Commander Rappard, Real 4. We were talking about your attempt to charge the Chief Yeoman aboard HMS Sheffield early on in your career as a midshipman.
Well, I'd nipped on board as quick as I could, terrified that the Commander-in-Chief had seen this awful thing happening in the boat on the way back and would be soon sending a fierce signal. And the officer watch, when I said I wanted to run in the Chief Yeoman for doing this awful thing, said, "Stotty, you can't do that. He's the Chief Yeoman." And I said, "But we're masked before the signal comes." And so the whole panoply of naval discipline was set up, but also set up in such a way as to protect the Chief Yeoman. So the defaulters' table was set up abaft Y turret, in the lee of Y turret. Sentries were placed to stop goofers coming along. The master at arms was provided. He was the senior, the only man in the ship senior enough to tell the Chief Yeoman to take his cap off. And the whole panoply of the defaulters' table then proceeded. And the cap was taken off, the charge was read. He'd commit an act to the prejudice of good order and naval discipline in that he did urinate over the side of His Majesty's boat at about 21:05, whatever time it was. And with great distaste, the officer watch, who was a lieutenant, turned to me and said, "Well, Snotty." So I took a pace forward and told my story and saluted and stood back. The officer watch leaned on the defaulter's table and smiled at the Chief Yeoman and said, "Well, Chief Yeoman, what's your side of this story?" Well, the Chief Yeoman glanced at me out of the corner of his eye and then said, "Well, sir, I know the midshipman's only just joined the ship, sir, and I also know he's saying exactly what he thought he saw, sir, but It seems possible that he hadn't appreciated that the cooling water of the starboard engine discharges overboard just below where I was standing, sir." And the officer watch interrupted him at this point. Said, "Of course, Chief Yeoman, case dismissed." And while the master at arms was saying, "On caps, about turn, etc., he turned to me, the officer watch, and said, "Be more careful in future, Snotty. See to it." "Aye, aye, sir," the only possible answer to that. So I got off the quarterdeck and wondered what on earth I'd dropped myself into. Next morning I heard that the midshipmen doing competitive flag hoisting exercises, and I was home fleet. All the midshipmen in the home fleet were doing these flag hoisting exercises. It was cold, it was 6:30 in the morning. And who was in charge? Chief Yeoman. Standing back a bit, the actual work was being done by one of his petty officer yeomen of signals and one of the leading signalmen. And they were giving us absolute hell, as usual, leading us a dog's life. You know, all on that line. "Quicker than that, sir. You've got that flag upside down." All this went. And we were criticized right, left, and centre. We were running around like multicolored flies doing the wrong thing. And the Chief Yeoman came over to me quietly and said, "Would you like a cup of curry, sir?" I said, "Yes, please, Chief Yeoman." And this great man, clearly a much greater man than I'd appreciated 24 hours earlier, was going to say something, and I was right out of my depth. I had no idea what was going to happen next. And so we went over to his caboose, which had been produced by the various chief petty officers in the mess with him, beautifully made of canvas by the sailmaker, power supplies from the chief torpedoman, extra supplies of cocoa and sugar and all the rest of it from Chief Pusser, I suppose, and a boy signalman already in there brewing up the water on a heater, which was also illegal, but warmed the place up a treat. And when we had our cocoa, Chief Yeoman came over to me and said, "About last night, sir." "Yes, Chief." "Well, a man in my position can hardly admit to a thing like that, sir. Now, could I?" And I thought, well, no. I suppose not, Chief. And I think that that taught me a very great deal, very quickly and soon in my time in Sheffield, about the importance of the Chief Petty Officer and how much I had to learn. I was as ignorant as they come, having done my 6 months. I'd been terrified of chief gunner's mates and so on, who'd made me do my men under punishment stuff. But where it all fitted together in a ship was something I hadn't come across before, and I was beginning to learn. And it was a process of learning that went on. Because for the first few months in HMS Sheffield, I was regarding the whole thing as the best rugger match I'd ever been in. We went out the North Sea.
Before we go into that, could you just tell me a bit about the gun room and sort of living conditions as a midshipman?
Living condition of the gun room. The gun room in Sheffield was a comparatively small compartment above the sea water. It had three or four portholes with deadlights, of course. And it was the deck above the midshipman's chest flat, where our clothes were meant to be stowed in chests of drawers and so on. But the armoured deck was the one on the level of the gunroom. So in order to go down to your chest flat, you had to get permission from the officer watch, because opening the hatch breached the watertight integrity of that part of the ship. So in practice, we had to keep our clothes in half a seaman's locker just outside the gunroom. And this made very, very, very restrictive, very difficult, partly because half a seaman's locker doesn't contain an awful lot, and the other half is invariably being used by somebody else who wants to get things out of it the moment you do too. I slept in a hammock.
How did you find that? I mean, I know you'd had
I'd learned how to sleep in a hammock, and I had the luxury of a hammock boy whose job it was, for 5 shillings a month, which I paid, to sling and stay the hammock for me. So I didn't have the business of having to actually lash it up and rig it.
Did you find it comfortable?
If the ship was rolling, it was very comfortable. If the ship was pitching, it was nothing like so comfortable. The combination of rolling and pitching together was so unpleasant that I tended to be leaping out of the hammock to go and be sick somewhere anyway. Because I was horribly seasick. It took me about 3 days at sea to recover sufficiently to be able to eat meals normally anyway.
How bad was it? I mean, how physically ill were you with seasickness? I mean, because people get it in different degrees. I think that
the feeling that one would prefer to die is quite common under those conditions, and I was in that state. And my friends used to take me and march me up and down the quarterdeck to try and recover in the fresh air. And it usually didn't do me much good.
Were you retching?
I retched till I was empty and then went on retching. And the problem was how to get something to retch on, which wasn't quite so painful.
Were there any cures you tried at the time, early on?
Discipline was one of the cures applied by the Navy, as clearly had been ever since the word go. And that was that if you make a mess, you jolly well clear it up yourself. So you'd better go round with a bucket, boy, until you grow up. So I tended to go round with a bucket. And there were occasions later at sea when I'd been in awful trouble for something. I really couldn't see straight because I was empty and retching and all the rest of it. And I was ordered to go up to the crow's nest and jolly well stay there till I was ordered to come down. So when I'd got up to the crow's nest, I was again most horribly sick all over the rest of the ship. And it was decided perhaps that was a bad thing. Was it hard to feel like death somewhere else?
Were you worse than most? Were you...
In that particular gunroom, I was the sickest, yes. But after 3 days, I was... Well, you only had the choice of dying or starting to eat normally, and I was got better.
Now, what about the food? Let's ask about the petty officer messman. If you could describe their role.
Their role was to see that we were fed by drawing the naval rations, whatever they were, and then adding whatever was possible to it. My contribution to adding to it while we were in Scarpa Flare, especially before I got under punishment for that too, was fishing for mackerel out of the scuttle. And their mackerel line is obtainable from the naval stores. Appropriate hooks were obtainable from the naval stores. And by opening up one's pillow, one could get some feathers and tie them onto the hooks. And with 12 hooks, you could count the number of bites you got and sometimes pull up 12 mackerel at once, because Scarpa Flow was obviously a good place for mackerel at that time of the year. Unfortunately, the commander was very interested in the appearance of his ship, and he would go round it in a boat and examine it, which bit needed to be painted or scrubbed or whatever it was. And he did not appreciate seeing fishing lines coming out of the gunroom portholes. And so I was under stoppage of leave or extra work or something again, once more, for being unseamanlike. Wasn't the only time, by any means, in trouble.
This petty officer and messman, how did it work then?
He was paid a certain amount by us every month.
Do you remember how much it was?
No, I don't. But as we were only paid 5 shillings a day, it couldn't have been very much. I think the order of 2 shillings, perhaps. And he dealt with the food thing. The drink thing was slightly different, because we had a bar and we had access to drink. And I didn't like spirits, whiskey and gin and so on. I'd never taken them, didn't want them. One or two of the other midshipmen, however, did. And there was a rule that we were only allowed to have 5 shillings a month best bill, wine bill. And of that, only 0.5 crown could be spirits, which sounds very little. But in fact, gin and whiskey were a penny a shot. And so it was quite a lot. Being a profiteer by nature, I sold my 0.5 crown mess bill for wine bill for 5 shillings to one of the other midshipmen, and therefore was able to consume the very expensive items like beer, which was 5p. And some of the others did drink. As it happens, I didn't. But I enjoyed my glass of sherry and some wine and so on, which were all ridiculously cheap.
Was your drinking, was it overall monitored?
Only by cost and by the limit. You mustn't go above your 0.5 crown for spirits.
Which you evaded.
And all right. 5 shillings altogether in a month.
What about your food? What food did you get and how was it served to you?
We normally had as much as we wanted of whatever was available. I don't really remember the details of it. But whenever the messman could buy fresh food ashore, he did. And he occasionally came back with a lot of eggs. And so we'd have eggs and bacon. But it was basically the same food that the sailors got, plus whatever he could pay for out of our 2 shillings a day messing costs.
And was there enough for a young lad?
I never felt hungry. After a meal, I had enough, yes. Because bread and butter and jam were not rationed.
Was there any attention paid to, you know, that you had a what they call now a balanced diet? In other words, vegetables, fruit, you know, vitamins, that sort of thing.
I have no idea. I didn't even know the phrase balanced diet in those days.
What was the sort of, in Scapa, what was the sort of typical daily routine for a midshipman? Was there a lot of...
Well, the hands were called about 6:30. And we had to get up pretty quickly because people going by underneath would knock into the hammocks anyway. And the hammocks had to be cleared up and stowed, so one had to be out of them and dressed decently. And we'd fall in with the hands. We were attached to a particular part of ship. And you'd fall in with them when they went to work.
And which part were you attached to?
I can't remember.
What sort of work was it then?
The sailor's work depended on what was happening, cleaning, painting, all those sort of things. In some cases, they might be dealing with boats. If you happen to be, as a midshipman, attached to one of the people who specialized in the boat work, the chippy and so on, then you might be doing it. Or if you were going down to the engine room, because you had to learn about the engine room and the boiler rooms, you'd go down and tack yourself on to a petty officer down there in order to see what was happening. In fact, we were being given the opportunity to learn how a ship worked.
So, basically, that's why you can't remember. You were actually being moved about.
I was being moved about. I was just a very lowly person in the setup. But at the same time, we had to have an action station, a cruising station, and we learned to keep watch as well.
What was, I think, cruising station and watches first? Then
cruising station was the one which was the lowest form of readiness at sea. But in fact, that meant we could fire some anti-aircraft guns at very short notice. And the moment you were going to sea, you increased the watertight integrity of the ship because you might hit a mine or something on the way out of harbour. We also went to action stations at night and stayed at action stations.
Now, hang on. Where would you be on cruising stations?
Cruising stations, one would be a watchkeeper, and the watchkeeper might be as captain's doggy, which meant that one attended the captain and was sent as a messenger. If there's something really unpleasant, he also had a messenger, a sailor, and if it was perfectly foul and he wanted a message taken down to the forecastle where it was cold, wet, and bloody miserable, he might say, messenger, no, or you stay up here. Snotty, go down to the forecastle. And one found oneself carrying messages, occasionally the sort of messages which made one into a perfect Charlie, because one didn't understand the message. You'd go down the other end and deliver it and have the whoever you were delivering it to laughing like a drain because you'd been caught out.
Practical jokes.
Practical jokes. In fact, midshipmen were an easy joke for anybody, really, in the ship. With the result that as we had to work harder than the sailors, because in addition to night watches and so on, we also had the instructor lieutenant teaching us maybe ship construction or stability or navigation in the afternoons when you were half asleep. They were sympathetic with us. The sailors actually felt we really were the last form of pond life, and they were on our side quite often.
What about the watchkeeping duties? So how would that work then? You've mentioned the acting...
At cruising stations, you'd probably be in four watches. Defence stations was two watches. And at night, you might sleep at your action station. And my action station was in the 6-inch transmitting station, which was the control room for the 6-inch guns in the ship. This transmitting station was manned by the Royal Marine Band and the bandsman. And the head bandsman was a chap who smelt. He didn't wash properly. And I slept on the deck next to him, and it was very low down under an awful lot of armored decks and hatches and so on. And underneath us, I think, was the oil tank, and up one side of the bulkhead at the after end of the TS was one of the water tanks. And with the ship moving about at night, you could feel it sloshing about. And I had to have a bucket down there, of course. I wasn't adding to the pleasant living of all the others in there by being sick in it and having to secure it in such a way that it wouldn't fall over. And after about 3 months or 4 months of doing that...
Now, what was that? I mean, that's the conditions on it, but what was the job on the 6-inch transmitting station?
My job was to follow a pointer by moving a small wheel. What it actually did, I'm no longer certain. But it played some part in getting the guns trained in the right direction. And I was learning, therefore, what the process was. I learned what this transmitting station actually did in relation to the guns and the sequence of orders and what it actually meant. I was moved from that after a few months up into, thank heaven, the fresh air, where I looked after the port air defense position just above the bridge on the port side underneath the service director. And the ship had not been fitted with its anti-aircraft director's forehead, I think something to do with supply or wartime or whatever, but they weren't there. So I was responsible for the lookouts. I controlled the star shell through a very large binoculars on a transmitting dais thing that went round. And I had the power to order people to open fire. If I'd been given authority, I could tell them when to open fire with the anti-aircraft guns, the 4-inch guns, as well as, surprisingly, some of the pom-poms which we had. And as time passed and we had excitements with our attacks and all the rest of it, I became quite good at it because the thing...
We'll look at that as we go through those incidents. Yeah. Was there anything else about sort of the daily routine? I mean, you've got the cruising station, there's the night thing. Anything else about, perhaps a bit more about these lectures you had from the First Lieutenant?
Do you
remember his name?
The Instructor Lieutenant Hogbin. And he rang me up last week.
What sort of what were the lessons like? I mean, how detailed were they?
Oh, very detailed indeed. And he supervised our star sites and so on. And he said of my navigation and pilotage, good, but ship construction shaky. G.L. Hogben, instructor lieutenant.
And he was the first ship's first lieutenant, was he?
No, he was the instructor lieutenant, the schoolie, he was called.
And what did you enjoy the lessons? I mean, or was it just hard graft?
Well, on the basis that at school I'd found mathematics and things more difficult, I found them very hard graft, especially if I'd been up most of the night. And I had an awful tendency to go to sleep while he was talking, which he fully appreciated. But he wrote to me the other day as well, and he said one thing he gave me full marks for was hockey. He was a New Zealander, very good at hockey. In fact, he was the chap who advised Eisenhower on changing the date of the invasion because of his weather forking. He was a Met man as well. So he was a great man, eventually, in his own right. And then he became frontly senior in ICI, I think, as well, afterwards. A lovely man. I thought he was very good news indeed. But I could not keep awake in the afternoon for his instruction.
Now, what was your first... the first period of action you appear to have been on from your notes is that you were on the Northern Patrol between Iceland and Greenland.
Well, in the North Sea... and in Northern Patrol, and I can't remember which came first. The Northern Patrol one was to try and stop the raiders breaking out into the Atlantic and getting at our merchant ships. We never actually found anything. We were by ourselves up there, and it must have been excitingly dangerous from the anti-submarine point of view, but we had no protection. And my post-war knowledge suggests that there were very few U-boats, in fact, out in that area.
What was the weather like?
Foul. The whole thing was, in recollection, that of torment from seasickness. My two friends taking me up on the quarterdeck and marching me up and down and virtually forcing me to eat so that I could have something to be sick with.
How long would you be out on a patrol?
Matter of weeks rather than days. Maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks. I don't remember fueling up there. We must have gone into Iceland or into maybe Faroe or somewhere to fuel, or back to Scarpa. In practice, I think that cruisers were kept up there in a sort of line across the exits north and south of Iceland. But the bigger picture was never transmitted to the midshipmen. We didn't know what pattern it was, just what was happening to us at the time. And in order to even find out where we were, we had to go up to the navigator's yeoman or ask the navigator or express an interest in something up there to find out what was going on. If anything was going on, as it did occasionally in the North Sea, because we hadn't been at sea very long, one has to remember, before Dunkirk or all the rest of it happened. So we were in the North Sea and we were being attacked by aircraft. And one of the forays we made was to support Lord Mountbatten's ship, which had been hit by a bomb, run into by an E-boat, and had a crashed Stuka on it, and was down to, so the water level was level with the top of the forecastle.
Was this the Kelly?
Kelly. And we cruised around it, and I had a vivid picture of the great man lying back in summery weather on his bridge, totally relaxed in a sinking ship, what looked like a sinking ship, while he's being towed back. And it's the picture of it stayed with me. And many, many years later, when I met him in another connection, I was able to remind him about that one and say I'd seen that going on, which interested him. But he was in another role at the time, like Commander-in-Chief of Mediterranean, and I was in another ship.
What about these air attacks? Is this really your first time in action?
First time in action. Best rugby match I'd ever played in.
Were you on the port air defences at the time?
I was, yes. I was up and seeing it all happen.
What do you remember of it? It
was terribly exciting that we personally weren't being attacked, that whatever the bombs were dropping, it wasn't terribly close to us. But the banging of the guns and the little black puffs and where the shells burst all over the place. And occasionally the noise of what we call the Chicago pianos, the multiple pom-poms, the four-barrel pom-poms, all added up to tremendous excitement and exhilaration and adrenaline and all the rest of it.
What were you actually doing?
Nothing much, except keeping a lookout for more aircraft and encouraging my lookouts to look out in the proper sectors as opposed to goofing over their shoulders in another direction.
But your ship wasn't actually attacked. I mean,
we were among those present, and we might have been at any moment, but in fact, I don't think we were. We moved from, as the Dunkirk operation proceeded, we were moved further down the North Sea to Immingham.
To be based at Immingham.
And it was while we were in Immingham that we received some orders for what to do in the event of invasion. So we must have been into the summer of 1940 by then, late summer. And we were told that if there was an invasion, it was our job to try and get at the landing craft with the soldiers in it and to ignore anything else. And that if we were in a sinking condition, we should endeavour to sink in shallow water and continue in action as a fort. And that stuck in my mind too as being a very real sort of statement. In practice, of course, it didn't happen. But we did occasionally make a tremendous foray out into the North Sea for reasons which now escape me, but must have been some thought that something was coming out and we might intercept it. And the captain took us at very high speed indeed into the North Sea, which is fairly shallow in places. And I was on the quarterdeck admiring the beauty of the very white wake and lovely blue sky and so on, when the ship apparently struck the bottom. The mast was seen to be shaking and all the signal halyards were flapping. And the huge white wake got very, very high above the level of the quarterdeck and started to overtake the quarterdeck. And at that moment I felt that I had to run like hell because obviously I was going to be overtaken by this wall of water. And I got up the after ladder above the quarterdeck up towards X turret just as it broke over the after end of the ship. And this was the first time I realized that although we were within our depth, the speed we were going took all the water out from underneath, pushed up a bow wave in front, and allowed the ship to drop. And what we'd done was fortunately to hit the sand rather than anything more solid. And there was no damage, amazingly.
Station number 22161, Commander David Rappard, Reel 5 on this side, Reel 6 the other side.